Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Welcome, folks. Strap yourself in. We're going to get right to the heart of the matter here. Back in early October, on a stage in Seattle, a man named Luis Elizondo stepped up to the microphone and said some things that forever changed the way we look at the topic of UFOs. He said that until a few days prior, he'd been in charge of a secret Pentagon program to study what we used to call UFOs or UAPs or unknown craft or flying saucers, call them what you will. The name of the program was ATIP, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. Lou Elizondo spent almost 10 years working on that program. This stunning news was reported at the time here and there, including on Coast. It made a bit of a splash in UFO circles. And then the world generally went back to eating cornflakes and arguing about Trump. In December, though, the New York Times reported the story. It was a great piece initiated by our friend Leslie Kane. It revealed that the Pentagon study was in fact real, that the civilian contractor for a few years anyway was Bigelow Aerospace here in Las Vegas, a separate entity called BAS, and that in general, this was serious stuff. At the same time, the Times story was published, an organization called To the Stars Academy, the one founded by rock star Tom DeLonge, the one which hired Lou Elizondo and arranged for him to appear on that stage, released two videos recorded by U.S. military units during encounters with technologically superior craft of unknown origin. All of this news was contrary to the official position of the U.S. government since 1969. That's when Project Blue Book ended, when the Air Force closed down its study, and I'm, of course, using air quotes around that word study, and said there's no evidence UFOs posed a threat to national security. Nothing to see here, folks. Move along. You and I didn't believe it. The general public didn't believe it. But it became a good excuse for scientists in particular, and for people in my line of work, journalists, to ignore this issue, the story, and its implications. Lou Elizondo's statements, the videos made public by To the Stars, the apparent willingness of at least some people in the Pentagon to engage in an open dialogue with the public on the UFO question is a huge story. No matter how you cut it, it's big. And it's a bigger change, I think, than I ever expected to see in my lifetime. And it's just getting started. As most of you probably know, Mr. Elizondo has done a couple of other interviews, a couple, that's putting it mildly. He was all over cable news for a couple of weeks. He did a couple of network news programs. He's talked to a bunch of newspapers. I've had a chance to interact with him twice, produce some stories for local TV news. But, of course, they're just stories that come in bite-sized chunks. He did a noteworthy long-form interview with the International UFO Congress and our friend Alejandro Rojas. That video was a centerpiece of their recent conference in Arizona. But there are many unanswered questions and a whole lot of harsh criticism, especially from the UFO diehards who have a long history of not only looking a gift horse in the mouth, but the tendency to punch that horse in the face as well. It's all a plot. It's all disinformation. Show us the alien bodies, et cetera, et cetera. Some have definitely twisted their panties into knots and have collapsed into spasms of the conniption fits the way they always do. Tonight, Lou Elizondo is here for 2 hours, and we will drill down and see what we can learn about the Pentagon study, about those videos, and about the future of this subject. That will happen in just a minute. In the second half tonight, another UFO revelation. John Greenwald, who runs the Black Vault website, made contact with someone who uncovered a cache of authentic documents from Project Blue Book, materials that were slated for disposal decades ago, but which somehow survived and are now available for you to see and read. John will be here to tell us that story, how it happened, and what's in the paperwork. I have some other business that we usually discuss in this part of the program. I think we'll get to that a bit later because I know you want to get right to it, so that's what we'll do. We will be right back with Luis Elizondo to ask about the ATIP program, the future of UFO research, and where it might lead. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Lou Elizondo is a career intelligence officer whose experience includes working with the U.S. Army, the Department of Defense, the National Counterintelligence Executive, and the Director of National Intelligence. He was conducted and supervised highly sensitive espionage and terrorism investigations around the world, ran clandestine source operations through Latin America and the Middle East, and has served as the Director for National Programs Special Management Staff, as well as for the last decade, he ran ATIP, a sensitive aerospace threat identification program focusing on unidentified aerial technologies, what we used to call UFOs. He's an inventor who holds several patents and most recently joined to the Stars Academy. We're going to cover all of those different parts of his life. But Lou, great to have you on the program. Been looking forward to it for a long time.
Mr. Knapp, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on your show.
Let's start with letting the audience know a little bit more about you. I had heard in the interview from the UFO Congress that you were at the University of Miami and decided to join the U.S. Army. No regrets about that, right?
No, none at all. Actually, it was the Army, I think, that, there's different phases in people's evolution of maturity. And in my case, I very much was always very interested in the hard sciences and the medical field, and my initial interest really was in the medical field. And when I had the opportunity after I graduated to serve my country, I jumped on that opportunity, and thinking ironically that when I joined I would probably stay in the medical field to some degree and maybe get into the world of maybe medical intelligence. And as fate would have it, actually, once I joined the Army, I wound up really realizing I fell in love with the intelligence piece more than the medical piece. And, the rest is, as they say, history.
You became an intelligence officer, and I think some people might think that's working behind a computer, plotting against spies, think of that sort. But you were you also had experience, boots on the ground, combat situations. And the reason I know that is you told me the first time we met about an experience and the circumstances of how you met General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, Mad Dog Mattis. We'll come back to why that's relevant later, but I wonder if you could share that story with us now.
Oh, my goodness. Sure. Well, first of all, I've had the wonderful opportunity to work with and for some of America's finest men and women. I call me a little bit biased, but I really reserve a special place in my heart for men and women in uniform. These are folks who do their jobs day in, day out. Many cases, it's a silent type of service, and they take their oath to the country very, very seriously. It's actually a way of life. So for me, I find myself in a situation where I deployed quite a bit, and in some cases lived overseas for extended periods of time, sometimes with my family and sometimes without my family. So intelligence is one of those things, I guess more esoterically, maybe a way to kind of explain how intelligence work basically is. It's a lot like playing a game of chess against an adversary, and in some cases you may never have a chance to actually see your adversary you're playing chess against. And there's all sorts of ways to do intelligence. There are people who do indeed sit behind a computer and they do things such as cyber and computer type stuff and analysis, and then there's other folks who actually have to go forward in the field and collect information. As you are aware, there's probably a whole handful of ways to do it. And in lay terms, there's you can collect information through airwaves and signals information. You can collect it through talking to individuals and human intelligence. You can do it through imagery and, a whole laundry list, if you will. Basically take the five senses that we have as human beings and amplify those into a career field. So if you can hear something, you can see something, you can feel something, chances are there's an intelligence field dedicated to that particular collection activity.
Again, the reason I was heading that way is I wanted people to understand the special relationship that you had with General Mattis. It becomes part of the UFO story later.
Sure.
Can you tell that publicly, the story of him saving your life?
For me, it began, unfortunately, after the events of 2001, September 11th, as most people my age will probably remember exactly what they were doing. And in my case, My journey with the secretary, then one-star General Mattis, began shortly after the events of September 11th. I found myself with a small task force attached with the U.S. Army, and we were the first Army unit in into Kandahar. And it was in Kandahar that I had the incredible honor to serve with then General Mattis, who was in charge of the Marine Expeditionary Unit. Again, some outstanding men and women, some of the finest this nation has. And we had a chance to work together. In fact, I was able to advise then General Mattis on some of the issues that we were seeing in Kandahar. We were running counterintelligence and human operations and interrogations at the time. And as the operations officer, I routinely interacted with the secretary.
There was some kind of situation where you were surrounded, right?
Oh my goodness! Well, actually, yeah, it was the entire airbase. It's not uncommon in situations like that when unfortunately you receive unfriendly fire, and it seems almost a nightly occurrence. Either the base was being rocketed or being mortared, or there were firefights out beyond the wire, and I distinctly recall one time some folks getting I have to be careful how much I say, but had gotten pinned down pretty bad, and Mattis was there, and he got a bit animated because we were unable collectively to get those folks out of there. And so he basically made the decision right there and then to send in some of his assets, despite the danger, and literally go in and save these individuals. In fact, it was literally a daily basis. I saw him make the call to do things that would normally probably make most people cringe.
Well,
as most heroes, right, understanding the difference between being risk averse and being risk aware, the secretary has always been risk aware. But in these cases, he knew the value of human life and would do anything and everything to protect it if it involved a U.S. soldier or a Marine or airman. And it was literally on a nightly basis. He would go out and make the order to go ahead and do something to make sure our folks remained safe.
The reason I was bringing it up is because of the special respect that you have for him. We'll circle back to that. Let's get to ATIP. So what's this? Describe the first inkling you have that they're going to recruit you to take this job.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't have an inkling until the very end. When I say the very end in 2008, had a couple conversations with some individuals. They had asked me at the time if I would consider going to talk to the program manager. I did, and the program manager at the time was a PhD and literally a rocket scientist out of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he indicated he was looking for some counterintelligence support. So we had some conversations initially with his staff, and then later on with him, and at that point, probably after the third conversation, it became apparent to me that what he was asking me to do was to support a portfolio that was considered a little unconventional. We're talking about extremely advanced technology, and as he's having this conversation with me, some of the parameters he's discussing, it becomes apparent to me that I wasn't aware that we had any technology like this in our inventory, and it became pretty clear after our third meeting that we didn't.
You were unaware that this program existed before the third interview or so.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I was completely unaware this program existed. That's a true statement.
Did you have any opinion about UFOs, that whole subject? Had you read anything or studied it
You know,
or?
forgive my ignorance on the topic at the time, but no, I didn't. For me, as I've mentioned before, to folks when they ask, you know, we all have jobs to do, and for my part, I really didn't give it much thought. I didn't watch UFO shows. I wasn't into any type of conspiracy theories. I was just busy doing my job day in and day out. Although, keep in mind, I do think that having a healthy degree of skepticism is always important. As an intelligence officer, we're trained to look at things with a keen eye and scrutinize. So in essence, try to replace supposition and speculation with observation and deliberation. So what we try to do is look at the data and really tease apart the details and the facts in order to let that drive our opinion. So no, I really didn't think much about the UAP phenomenon at all until I was asked to come into the program.
But at some point, it has to dawn on you, holy moly, I'm studying UFOs or UAPs. You don't have to call them ETs or aliens, but these are unknown craft. It must have dawned on you what your job was, and that must have been quite a moment.
It did. You know, for some people, it's a bit of an epiphany, a bit of an aha moment where, oh my goodness, I'm actually looking at something I really don't understand. In other cases, it's more of a slow and gradual realization. I think for me, it was more of a slow and gradual realization. For me, it was just day in, day out, realizing that the exotic technologies we were looking at were really something worth exploring. It was fascinating and in some cases maybe even a little bit scary, but yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think for most of the folks in the organization that I worked in, there comes a point where we realize that it's definitely a profound topic to be exploring.
And it's real.
And it's real, absolutely. It is absolutely real. Make no mistake about it.
Would you explain to our audience the concept of stovepipes in the Department of Defense? We in this business and in this program, we'll tend to say the Pentagon says this and the Pentagon says that as if it speaks with one voice. But most people don't know what you did, right? They have no idea. Even you told me the first time we met, your immediate supervisor had no idea that you were doing this, which is astonishing.
Right. So, Mr. Knapp, the way it works in the department, and especially in the classified arena, sometimes there are programs that a limited number of people can be part of, and that decision is usually made by very senior people. And there is a list, and basically you're either on the list or you're off the list. And it's not really uncommon in the intelligence community or the Department of Defense that you'll have pockets of expertise and pockets of individuals and offices working on a project that are compartmentalized from other efforts within the department. And that compartmentalization is necessary oftentimes to make sure that the information remains protected and preserved, the integrity of that information. However, in other cases, those stovepipes can also lead to inefficiencies and unfortunate lack of communication. Imagine your household, for example. There are conversations between a husband and a wife that you don't necessarily want to always tell the kids. Maybe it's about the finances of the household or what you're going to, you know, get for the holidays for everybody. But in other cases, there's conversations you definitely want to make sure you keep the entire family involved in. And those are decisions maybe like a family move that you're going to be making somewhere or big decisions that everybody's going to be part of. So very much the same way in government, there are topics, there are areas of studies and operations that you don't necessarily share with everybody else throughout the department, especially those that are very, very sensitive, in order to control those efforts and protect that information. But in other cases, if you can't communicate that information up to senior leadership, then that compartmentalization actually winds up becoming a problem. So it's a bit of a catch-22.
Well, it becomes a problem for you. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But the point I'm making was that your immediate supervisor did not know. It was somebody up above him that knew what you were doing. You were doing a couple of different jobs, but one of them was studying UFOs.
That's correct. Yes, I mean at the very senior levels, they were aware of what I was doing. The problem is at the middle management level, not so much. And I think, you know, in defense of, I hate to say defense of the Department of Defense, but I think it's important that your listeners understand that the Department of Defense is very, very good at almost every mission that is given. It is a huge organization full of wonderful Americans and patriots.
I'll tell you what, Luis Elizondo, hold on there. We're going to take a break. Richie Havens taking us into the break with a classic George Harrison song. Our conversation with Luis Elizondo about the Pentagon's UFO program continues in just a moment. We're talking with Luis Elizondo about the ATIP program, the secret Pentagon study of UFOs, where he worked for almost a decade, until he stepped out on that stage in Seattle last October. Most of the people he worked with in the Pentagon had no idea that this program existed. That included, as we just heard, his immediate supervisor. He didn't know that he had been given this assignment. You can imagine the kind of ripples that sent through the Pentagon and the blowback that Lou Elizondo has had to endure since. We're going to get into the daily operation of ATIP, how it worked, what kind of information came in, where it came from, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Lou Elizondo, let's talk about that name, ATIP. You know, it doesn't mention anything about flying saucers or unknown aircraft or little green men. It does mention the word threat, though. Is that title, is that sort of carefully chosen as a partly political decision in that you don't want it to be seen as frivolous to protect the money, and you also want to, if you're the Department of Defense and you're studying something, it had better be something that could be viewed as a threat.
Right. So, Mr. Knapp, you're precisely correct. Keeping in mind that the Title X authorities for the Department of Defense are pretty clear, and you know most of the folks that come into the Department of Defense and the services take an oath to defend this country from all enemies, foreign and domestic. So, as a result, by definition, the mission of the Department of Defense is to protect this country from any and all threats external of its borders, to include anything that may even potentially be an existential threat. So, if something is not a threat, then traditionally, that's probably the job of another organization or agency within the government. Department of Defense tends to be an organization that is really postured to address threats, and that is what we do.
But again, you don't want to mention anything about what it might be. You want to leave it sort of generic, because you don't want it to appear to be frivolous, and you want it to be taken seriously. And somebody right. might get the wrong idea if you say you're chasing aliens.
Right. Well, and look,
you don't know.
We don't know. And I think it'd be disingenuous for me to tell you that we know who's behind the wheel and whatnot. Really, when, as I've said before, my focus has always been, I don't want to say it was simple, but really my mission was pretty clear cut. And that was to determine with those of my colleagues, what is it we're seeing and how does it work? And then hopefully let, you know, smarter people figure out who's behind the wheel and what the intentions were. I figured if we could just focus on those two areas, then we probably would stand a really good chance of figuring everything else out.
And in a given day, how does it work? You report to work and what? There's a stack of cases or information on your desk?
Yeah, well, it's a bit of feast and famine sometimes. I think people would be surprised to hear that, you know, there are days where literally nothing regarding ATIP occurred. It literally was just even some weeks, frankly. And then weeks would go by. And then in other times, you would have this flurry of reporting coming in. And that reporting could come in various ways. It could come in with eyewitness testimony. I might come in with electro-optical data, radar returns, written reports, intelligence reports. So there were a whole litany of ways that we could receive information, and we did receive information. So I wish I could say it was pretty much you show up to work with a cup of coffee, sit down and start reading reports. That wasn't always the case. Sometimes you were up for 12 or even longer hours trying to analyze information and make phone calls and call meetings and have the experts try to do the telemetry. And in other cases, you know, maybe it was you had time to sit back, drink a cup of coffee, and catch up on the news. So it wasn't like you would imagine maybe on TV where we did that all day, every day. We also had other jobs as well. So our other jobs kept us very, very busy. And not to mention, you know, of course, then you throw on top of that responsibility. A lot of us were dual-hatted. So basically we had you know, two or three different jobs within the department. It's not uncommon at all. And we would try to, if we could, divvy up our time accordingly. Now, if something hot came in, clearly we would reprioritize, look at what we have going on, and then see if we could all get together and you know, maybe spend the next few hours or sometimes days or even weeks.
Something hot means, what does something hot mean? Like, what would be dramatic?
Well, I don't know, so let me be careful how I answer that, because I still do have a security clearance, or at least I think I still do. So I can't talk about anything that may be classified or sensitive, but let me give you an example that everybody is aware of. The Nimitz Carrier Group, battle group, that was in 2004 off the coast of California. If we were to get a report, let's say off the coast of the Atlantic, that a carrier group has just encountered some very interesting radar hits, keeping in mind a carrier group is not just an aircraft carrier, right? It is a huge muscle movement for the Department of Defense. Basically, it is like taking a piece of New York City with radar and individuals and logistics and pretty much anything and everything, and putting it out to sea. So there is a great deal of coordination that goes in when you send out a carrier group. You have submarines, you have destroyers, you have cruisers, you've got aircraft with radars, and you have, of course, the carrier itself. So because these things are such huge investments, we protect these investments. We protect them a lot. So as these things are out to sea, when you start getting weird radar hits or you start getting pilots reporting that they're seeing something, that information would trickle to our office. And then all of a sudden we'd begin to realize, hey, looks like we may have something going, we have a real event. And depending on the types of information we would receive in return would give us a good understanding if this was something that was just simply let's say a cruise missile test, or maybe a civilian aircraft in the AOR, or if this was something else. And that was usually, we could usually figure that out very quickly by the flight performance of what we were seeing. The radars we have are very sophisticated. These are instruments that are highly tuned and help the pilot very quickly identify what we call friend or foe. In many cases, we can identify not just the aircraft, but in some cases, you know, even to the degree of where the aircraft was made in some cases. So we know very quickly what's in our skies, or at least we should. And if we don't, then we need to put more eyes on target. And so that's with radars and more pilots and whatnot. When these carrier groups go out and they start picking up anomalous radar returns that are fitting certain profiles, that is something we want to look at. That is something we do look at.
So, you know, 2004, the Nimitz incident, and we're going to get into it in the Tic Tac video. But if that had happened, that didn't happen while on your watch. That was before you got onto the program. Were you aware of it? Were those files something that would be available to you while you were part of ATIP?
We were absolutely aware of it. And that's just one example. I'm talking about that example only because that's the one that's out in the media now and everybody knows about. But I can tell you there were other events like the Nimitz events that occurred after the Nimitz, and not in the distant past either. Unfortunately, like I said, I have to be cognizant of what I say, but you know, I'm using the Nimitz simply as an example. But there were other very, very compelling incidents that we continue to look at.
I guess the comparison you could make is if the Nimitz group is off the coast of San Diego doing maneuvers and a Russian sub somehow gets through the perimeter and surfaces right behind it, people would freak out, right?
Yeah.
How,
I mean,
how did that happen?
Look at recent news, right? How many times have you seen in major headlines when a Russian aircraft enters U.S. airspace, whether it be over Alaska or near California? We immediately scramble two jets. It's on the headlines of the news, and all of a sudden, people want to know how the heck did this happen. And in some cases, if there are aircraft coming into our airspace, you know, there may be even calls for congressional testimony, and in some cases, people get fired. So it's a big deal. And so when you have these things coming into our controlled airspace, and unfortunately, there's not a flag or a tail number on these things that we can look and say, oh, that's from country X or country Y. In fact, some of these things don't even have a tail at all. That's what was so perplexing. It was crickets. People didn't want to have the conversation, and yet here these things were having incursions into our controlled airspace. You're right. If it had been a Russian sub or a North Korean aircraft or anything else, I think we'd be having a completely different discussion right now.
But it's not exactly reassuring that you don't know where it's from. The fact that it's if it had been Russian, well, that would be bad enough. The fact that you don't know where it's from, that seems to be more disturbing, I would think.
Well,
that's where the threat comes in, right? That it intrudes in your...
If I may try to distill this down as in very simple terms. Look, there's really three options here, in my opinion. And I could be wrong, Mr. Knapp. I'm just giving you my take on things. But I think there's three options. One is, as people have said, well, maybe this is secret American test aircraft that we're testing. And I would say, okay, that's fine. But if that is the case, first of all, that would be, it's very unlikely, because you would never test an advanced aircraft next to a carrier battle group with F-18s and other aircraft nearby. You just don't do that. And by the way, if you do, you're going to coordinate it. One side of DOD is going to coordinate it with the other side. So if that's the case, then excuse the vernacular, but then we're really screwed up internally in our coordination. So the other option is that this is not a U.S. aircraft, but this is a foreign aircraft, as some people have said, or foreign technology from maybe an adversarial country. And if that's the case, then I would say, well, if there is a nation that is displaying an aircraft with these technologies that can come into our airspace and has been for quite some time, able to come in and out whenever it wants, sometimes completely undetected, and able to do what it's doing, then frankly, as a department and as a nation, we would be screwed externally. And the last option is that it's neither ours or theirs. And then in that case, I hate to say it, but we may all be screwed. So I'm concerned, because I look at it from the optic of, if it's not ours, which is, we were 99.999% sure it's not. The reason why I'm not saying 100%, because I'm sure some listener out there will probably criticize me for saying we're 100% sure.
Welcome to ufology.
Yeah, but we are as close to being 100% sure as I think as anybody could be. Could it be a foreign technology? Sure, but then you know what? We got even a bigger significant problem on our hand, because there is a country that is light years ahead of us in technology. And so we better damn catch up.
Can you give me a general parameter of the number of cases that you would have dealt with in the almost decade you were with ATIP? Is it hundreds? Is it thousands?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot. I mean, I think what's important to note here is, you know, metrics can be a funny thing. You can look at data, and as I was explaining this to a friend of mine. Let's go back, not to pick on New York, but let's pick on New York for a second. Let's say, just hypothetically, the announcement comes out tomorrow that crime in New York City has increased by 10%. Now, some folks will look at that data and say, oh my gosh, New York's become more dangerous. Other folks may look at it and say, actually, the police are doing a better job because they caught more criminals and they were better funded this year, and so therefore, it's not that crime rate is up, we've just caught more criminals. Other people will look at the data and say, no, actually, it's a fact that the citizens of New York are now more hypersensitive and aware of their surroundings and are reporting more suspicious activity. So metrics can it depends on how you look at the metrics, but in some cases you may have back to your original question, maybe one or two events in a month. Other cases you may have multiple events going on simultaneously at the same time on the same day.
So you could say hundreds in your tenure? Hundreds?
Well, I will say a lot. Unfortunately, the specific number I have to be careful with. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about that, but I would say it's enough to give us a very compelling picture that what we were seeing, there were some congruencies and some analysis that could be done that allowed us to better, in some cases, understand what we were looking at, the physics at least.
Have you got any, we're going to get into the physics in the next hour. Have you got any cases that come to mind that you're able to talk about where humans were physically harmed? You know, we don't have these things flying over American cities, blasting us with laser beams or something, a la Independence Day. But they do intrude. Are there any cases that you guys studied where humans were hurt?
Hurt is it or affected?
Well, affected. We'll start with that one.
Look, I think anytime anybody comes into contact with something we don't understand, there are effects on a human being, both mentally, emotionally, and maybe even physically. I'm not trying to be evasive here. I just want to make sure I answer your question without getting myself in trouble.
Right. Well, how about that?
Some of the reports that we would get in were very interesting because you would have people, besides saying, I saw something, they would say, you know, it's interesting because I had this weird, weird loss of time perception. While I was engaging or while I saw it, it almost felt like time stood still, or in some cases, I looked at my watch and all of a sudden, now, 30 minutes had gone by and there's no way that could have happened. In other cases, some people reported being a little bit nauseous. Now the question is, you know, were they nauseous because they were scared because of the fight or flight reaction that we all have as human beings, or were they nauseous as a product of something else? Look, we have the latest headlines right now in Cuba, right, with what people are reporting as a sonic attack. And based upon someone was exposed to something, now there are some individuals, Americans, who seem to have been injured by something down in Cuba.
We were talking about things that are dramatic. Did you know, the stories we have heard about UFOs appearing over U.S. nuclear missile bases, disabling the launch control mechanisms or communications. Was there anything like that on your watch, or can you say?
I can say that there were some very interesting events that interfered with DOD technologies. I can't go into specific locations, sources, and methods. That would be up to the Department of Defense to provide you. But what I can say is that, yes, there were incidents in which DOD technical equipment appeared to be in some cases manipulated or even disabled in a manner that was not advantageous to us.
That's a very diplomatic way to put it. We're talking with Lou Elizondo about the ATIP program. When we come back, a few more questions about how it operated and then how it interacted with BAS, the Bigelow Aerospace Organization, the private contractor that got a lot of these cases and files in order to analyze. Much more to come here, including Tic Tac, Gimbal, and To the Stars Academy and where things might be heading.